is the big system that we are looking at right now? How does one recognize that your money is moving through that system in a way that doesn't align with your values?
I often talk about financial systems just as all the ways in which large amounts of money are moving. I'm talking about the ways in which our individual and collective choices around money are interconnected and tied. The sense of overwhelm of like, you know, I don't want to make the wrong decision, or how do I know who to support? Or what if I, you know, need this money for something else? As women of color, we have the added layers of patriarchy and racism. And so, you know, being able to reflect on what's accessible for us right now, what is our capacity in any given moment, and being able to just take basic looks at.
This is the Brown Way to Money podcast, where women of color in business find their financial independence path. Welcome back, sis, to another episode of Brown Way to Money podcast. Today we are talking about a topic. It's one of the questions that you guys have sent the most in the couple of days. I wanted to give you an insight on how this has to do with things that has happened in the past, if at all, and what can we do. Today, I want to equip you with the tools that we can use right now to do something about it. So thank you so much, Jasmine, to be here and to be talking this heavy topic with us.
Yeah, well, it's great to be back and always in conversation with you.
Let's dive in into it. When you wrote about financial activism, you outlined the steps inspired what was happening back in the prisons at the moment. I think that was...
It's like 2016,
2018, right?
Yeah.
But in what ways does the landscape today, 10 years later, feel similar or different than how it was back then?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'll take 2018 as kind of like the hallmark, because that's when I was most involved and really began writing the financial activist playbook because of the mass family separation we were seeing here in the U.S. by ICE and government officials. And so what has unfortunately stayed the same is the targeting of migrants, right? The ability for there to be kind of a systemic violence against people who, the kind of target is the same. However, what's changed is that in 2018, there was kind of a big focus on what was called, you know, Trump's zero tolerance policy, where we saw family separation largely concentrated at the U.S.-Mexico border. And really, there was this idea of prosecuting folks who were in this country, quote unquote, illegally, and keeping them in these detention centers for as long as possible. What's different now is this kind of mass deportation agenda in 2026, where the crisis is really not just happening at our borders or like border checkpoints. It's happening throughout the entire country. It's happening what we're seeing right now in Minneapolis, that folks may be following the news, that the entire population of folks who are undocumented or from mixed status families, right? Tens of millions of people, rather than just new arrivals, are being targeted. And it really is kind of intentional psychological warfare, even for people who have full documentation, right? Hearing these heartbreaking stories of children at school asking, well, can I be taken? Am I going to be
taken?
So I think that, you know, the scale in some ways has expanded. And I think that also the systems behind it, there's a really heavy for-profit incentive for private prison operators who, again, just profit from these contracts with ICE, as well as the detainment in these facilities. Now, the state violence, again, still concentrated on Black, brown, immigrant, poor folks, is really being used as a tool of chaos to intentionally isolate people and disrupt kind of ongoing organizing. So that's the landscape. You know, it is still kind of, for me, it will always be, how do we reckon with finance and money as a tool that is political, that can be leveraged? However, it is not about kind of a perfect set of actions or ethics. It's about learning how money already moves through systems of harm and then redirecting it towards care, safety, collective survival today and every day.
So if we talk about money moving through those systems, what are these the big system that we are looking at right now? How does one recognize that your money is moving through that system in a way that doesn't align with your values?
Yeah. So I often talk about financial systems just as all the ways in which large amounts of money are moving. We also have kind of systems that are less accessible to the everyday person, which is our monetary systems, our banking systems, but our financial systems are all inherently connected to us because they run on us, right? And sometimes with us, but more often than not, kind of off of our labor. And so when I talk about our financial systems, I'm talking about the ways in which our individual and collective choices around money are interconnected and tied. You know, I think that one of the kind of, I'll just speak to this directly, the sense of overwhelm of like, you know, I don't want to make the wrong decision, or how do I know who to support? Or what if I, you know, need this money for something else? I like to just start with some grounding that the only wrong, quote unquote, way to start is to not start at all. Right. And so allowing people to remind themselves that we, especially as women of color, are experts in our own lived reality and in the nuances of having to navigate capitalism. Right. We all have to navigate the contradictions of capitalism every day. As women of color, we have the added layers of patriarchy and racism. And so, you know, being able to reflect on what's accessible for us right now, what is our capacity in any given moment, and being able to just take basic looks at, okay, what is my money doing in the world from cash flow, you know, choices of where it's coming in, how it's going out, where it's parked, right, in the types of credit unions, CDFIs, banks. And then also thinking about risk, right? Again, we know our capacity and our risk tolerance best. And so being able to choose actions that kind of honor that experience, and also knowing that, you know, impact comes less from doing everything and more from doing one thing consistently, and in relationship and accountability to others. And so at a super high level, just being able to take accountability for our own experience with money and really starting there rather than getting overwhelmed in the kind of larger systemic BS that we are not responsible for.
And I just want to touch on something that you said at the beginning and you mentioned here again on the part of the system is the psychological effect of what this is happening, right? So one of the things that I focus the most as women of color is that our experience with money is heavily shaped by the generations that had, like, generations before, the scarcity, their experiences, but it is also being shaped by the history that those generations didn't tell us, right? So we have a quote-unquote unspoken history that we know about that lasted for more than 400 years that is still somehow playing, and it comes with the safety kind of trigger, right? Is it safe for me to have a voice on this? Is it safe for me to be the owner of my own money decisions? At that point, how do you think the systematic targeting and the narrative that we are seeing is affecting and having an effect on that psychological trigger, and how you kind of navigate that at the same time?
Yeah. It's a big question, right? Because it's about both the personal and collective moments of grief and rage and confusion. Yeah. And you know, and I think that, again, like, what's really intentional about what's happening here is planned chaos. Right. Like, there is such a sense of disorganization, of, you know, feeling like folks are on guard, even here in California. Right. I'm in the Bay Area, in Oakland, and it's a very progressive kind of historically, you know, deep organizing history here. And we also had a scare in which ICE agents were deployed right down the block from me. Fortunately, they were kind of pushed out by our local government, and our city has decided to take a stand against it. But we also had that moment, even our little protected bubble of, we were not ready, you know, for even like the possibility of this. And so I think that we need to acknowledge there are different levels of harm and discomfort and violence, you know, for folks who are in themselves undocumented or in mixed status families. The level of threat is obviously heightened and high. But for so many of us who aren't in that position, we can still feel that the kind of ongoing trauma. And I think actually, like, that's just a testament to the collective power of empathy and solidarity. However, where that gets in the way is when we then become stuck or overwhelmed, uh-huh. where we can't actually do the things that are helping our neighbors who are in the highest risk positions. And so, right. yeah, I think that like being able to tend to our own experiences, be able to give our nervous systems the like, yeah, this is a lot. Like maybe, you know, I know for me, I had deleted Instagram and TikTok for all of January, which was amazing. I'm just going to say that. But also it made it really hard for me to like have a good pulse on where are the actions happening today? You know, what are the calls to action, demands? And so I think being able to check in with ourselves and figure out like, okay, how much is enough for me? I think I spent like I mentioned, a couple hours last night just kind of scrolling through and catching up. And then being like, I actually know, like I don't need to, you know, see more images of children uh-huh. being detained or violence. I'm like, that's not actually serving or like fueling me right now. What is fueling me and what is nourishing me to want to participate is the kind of reminders that community is our greatest form of wealth. And thinking about in my context, community literally means my household, my neighbors, you know, folks who I'm connected to, and the kind of broader community of migrants, folks like me who come from kind of mixed status families or migrant families, and being able to, yeah, just use some kind of loving discernment around what is and isn't ours to do.
So what will be those steps that we can take right now to be that self-advocate, to be financial activist? Hey, sis, quick interruption of this episode here. I need you to please stop whatever you're doing and share this podcast with those three besties, three friends that you know you will talk about money, entrepreneurship, financial success, or hard conversations like the ones that sometimes we have here on this podcast. The only way that we can get to grow this podcast is with your help. From our perspective, and I think I want to expand this just a little bit on phrasing that being a financial activist doesn't mean that you have to go and speak up, because I understand, I know that trauma can hinder that ability to speak up. I understand mm-hmm. that not everybody will go in social media, not everybody will call the senator, but you have a responsibility to, if you're feeling that this is not in alignment with you, to do something. So I want to talk about those steps that you can do as an individual that nobody needs to know about if they don't want to, if you don't want to share it. So what are some of those, that pathway that you can provide?
Yeah. So this is in both times of crisis and in times of kind of relative stability. I think the biggest way that you can make an impact kind of with your voice or, you know, with your money is reminding ourselves that actions speak louder than words, right? And so how you model your relationship to money to those around you has a huge impact. I know that you're a mom, right? And so thinking about the ways in which like kiddos pick up on so much, whether it's intentional or not, but so do other humans, so there are adults, you know, humans in our lives pick up on the messaging that we seed. And so I think being able to, again, kind of take loving accountability of our own decisions around money, not from a lens of judgment and saying, or perfectionism, right? But from a lens of participation and momentum. So I think being able to kind of take stock in the financial activist playbook, I lay out 8 strategies of financial activism, everything from, like, again, how you talk about money, where you bank, how you spend or don't spend, where you give and receive kind of in the name of philanthropy, mutual aid that actually has nothing to do with money, but has a lot to do with kind of social capital and other resources, how we think about our investments, our budgets, and finally, our places of work and our businesses, right? Something that is really top of mind for folks today. And we're recording this just so for folks some context on January 30th, which is a national shutdown / day of action today. In solidarity with migrants across the country in response specifically to the ongoing and highly racialized and violence federal immigration enforcement, aka ICE operations, that have been concentrated in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area that have led to some fatal shootings of U.S. citizens by federal officers and has sparked widespread protests and calls for agent removal, lots of legal challenges and court restrictions on like enforcement tactics. So all in all, there's been a kind of ongoing conversation around civil rights and the use of force that has led to today, aka general strike and anti-ICE demonstrations around the country and world. In short terms, a hot ass mess. A lot, right?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, as we're having this conversation here today, thinking about, you know, some folks are not showing up to work, right? They have that feels within their kind of risk tolerance where they're saying, intentionally making a statement to their employer or with their employer in some cases and saying, like, we are not going to continue business as usual today, as a kind of symbolic way to demonstrate that what's going on is unignorable. For some other people, not working today is not an option. Makes especially sense. For, again, surrounded by a litany of amazing small businesses that are immigrant run and have migrant workers, and closing a day, especially on a Friday, where
it's not visible.
It's just not realistic. It's not realistic. Exactly. It's not visible. And it's not really that strategic, right? And so, again, this is a day where we get to kind of grapple with the nuances of collective action and saying that what matters less is the kind of one singular thing we all do. What matters more is the national signal that is being sent by the aggregate of all of those actions together.
And just to give an overview of the effects of this, the benefit, talk to us a little bit about the results of your aid strategies back in the day, because that it's also telling something. This is not like a effort just to say, oh, I did it. It actually has an effect. So what happened back then that you also put into the book?
Yeah. So in 2018, like I mentioned at the top of the podcast, we were in a very similar climate where there was really visible, really public mass raids on migrants that led to their detention and notably family separation. And so what we did, and I say we with a very big capital W, because it was, you know, hundreds of grassroots organizations, individuals, right? We have such a mix of visible actions and invisible actions, having coordinated actions around banks in particular, the big banks who were financing and profiting from the migrant detention centers in which over 70% of migrants were being held. So we had those very clear data. And at that time, it was a very obscure and unknown fact that there was this direct profit motive or business motive. So we really focused on making that legible and clear to everyday people, which looks like having protests outside of big headquarters to spread the word. It also looks like insider strategy of having investors and shareholders of those banks write letters, take shareholder activism, get on the kind of foam with their, not just their government representatives, but their corporate representatives within these banks to say, like, hey, we don't like how you're using your money. You have the opportunity to choose differently, and kind of laying out the roadmap for collaborative action with folks working within those institutions. So what ended up happening was we collectively put so much pressure onto these big banks that we saw close to $2 billion, the majority of big bank financing to private prisons be halted. When I say halted, there's some nuance. It's not like when you're invested in these types of vehicles, which don't need to go too deep into it, but essentially the private prisons were structured as real estate investment trusts, which, yeah.
Jeez.
Which made it more confusing for investors to actually know that we're not just investing in like condos and apartment buildings, we're also investing in prisons. So we made that really legible and clear. Yeah. It could be a whole other way.
Exactly.
So intentional obscurity about what's going on. So we made it really clear what was happening. And then we were able to get these banks, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, SunTrust, so on and so forth, to make these public statements saying, we do not agree with the administration's targeting of migrants. We will no longer renew our lending contracts to these institutions, which was successful and which was great and a lot of momentum, so much so that the private prison operators sued us for defamation. Long story for another time. But we caused so many millions of dollars in damage that they had to rethink their strategy. What that has ended up looking like, kind of unsurprisingly, is a lot of rebranding, a lot of changing the types of investment structures, and a continuous use of finance as an obscuring force to actually talk about what's going on. And so what we did then was demystifying, was bringing into public awareness, here's what's actually happening, which is, again, what we're seeing today, and making legible the strategies that are accessible, not just to the, you know, quote unquote, sophisticated investors or the finance folks, but the everyday people who can engage with those strategies. And so that is where the kind of mix of really practical strategies from what's your banking institution, where are you shopping, you know, what are the organizations you're donating to, are strategies that can be kind of experimented with and played with at the individual level, even when you're not kind of a wealth holder or someone who has access, excess income.
I I have this article on my head that went live, like, I think last week from Forbes, where they showcase all of the big companies that are getting big contracts from ICE, who is providing the cell phones, providing all this kind of network. Because what we just talked about is from the bank perspective, and you are depositing your money and all of that. Is there any way that you see that it will be helpful for people to review that list and think, how do we do business with these companies? Because they all have competitors. They all have an alternative, but those companies are the one getting the big contracts from ICE. And I'm thinking here, what can we do? Because we don't have that level of information right now. Like you guys did in 2018, but there is some information coming up. So how can people act when they see those kind of lists? Okay, you are hearing us talking about all of these steps that you can take. But if you want the condensed version and something that you can read, go ahead to brownwaytomoney.com/financialactivism to download a guide where Jasmine has laid out all the specific steps that you can take today. Back to the episode.
Yeah. So I'll give one example that I think is both interesting because it has some nuance and also interesting because I think it's just super creative. Home Depot is, you know, the largest kind of, I don't know, home construction resources. There are a lot of alternatives, but Home Depot is kind of like the go-to corporation that has been complicit with ICE. What people are doing, because there is this nuance that like the leadership of Home Depot has been very kind of pro-Trump administration in their actions. But the people who are hired at Home Depot sometimes are migrants themselves, right? And are workers who are trying to do what's best for their families. And so one thing that people are doing today and have been doing over the week is going to Home Depot and buying like, you know, less than a dollar worth of ice scrapers.
Yeah, I saw that.
As a symbolic tool. And that is what they're buying and returning, right? What this does, so notably, they're not being a-holes to the workers who work there, right? They're still doing business and it's not illegal, right? They're not doing anything that's necessarily putting themselves or anyone else at risk, but they are kind of changing the everyday productivity that is expected out of Home Depot, which I haven't checked on their stocks today, but I can imagine is going to have some kind of direct input in which we have seen throughout history on the stocks. Will that be lasting financial impacts that completely devastates Home Depot's business model? Probably not. However, the importance of financial activism is really, again, about being able to capture, especially in the attention economy where attention is so scarce for so many of us because there's so much competing with it, is being able to really kind of pinpoint a way to challenge and to say, like, even when you're more powerful and have more financial resources than us, we have deep creativity, we have community, we have time, and we have relationships that allow us to participate in ways that are disruptive. We can keep doing that, right? And so what this kind of symbolic actions do, or the ability to kind of look at who are the complicit corporate partners and how can we take a stand, for some of us, that means that we are investors in those companies and that we divest or we retain our shares and become shareholders of these companies where we then have an active voice in governance. That's one strategy. For most of us, not realistic, right? And so our strategies are going to be as consumers. And how can we as consumers participate in ways that respect the human dignity of workers, especially migrant workers, and also challenge the kind of profitability and business as usual for some of these organizations?
Love it. Okay. And I need to ask this question kind of like to conclude the conversation. There is a lot of women right now listening to this podcast and reading the articles that they don't know how to navigate this conversation because their partner may not agree with their values and vision of what, you know, the state should be. How can they stand up and own their voice, kind of like follow this financial activism path when you have to, you know, it's your partner. You don't want to talk about divorce, at least not yet. How can they do that?
Yeah, that's real. It's a really kind of unfortunately common dynamic I see. I am a firm believer that we all deserve our pockets of peace. We deserve our safe spaces in which we can, you know, tend to our immediate world, even when the kind of bigger world may feel like it's on fire. And so, you know, I think that sometimes. Again, every single relationship is different, whether it's your spouse or maybe you're with, you know, you live intergenerationally and it's your, you know, you live with elders.
Yeah, that's a big one too.
I think that arguing with folks without there being kind of consent that we're looking to kind of, you know, further dialogue, or we're looking to kind of come to some kind of family agreements, is kind of akin to like arguing with strangers online. Like, that's probably less useful of your energy than like actually, you know, calling your senator or being able to make a decision. Yeah. And so I think that, like, this is not to say, like, if, again, you are an expert in your own lived reality, you know your relationship best, you know what's in your capacity, you know when your nervous system is regulated enough to like go into those deeper conversations that may be uncomfortable. And no one is going to shame you for someone else's beliefs, right? Like, what you're accountable is for is yourself and the way that you show up in the world and the way that you model that. And I actually fear that if we focus so much on the interpersonal relationships that lead to burnout, we are less likely to be kind of sustained in the work of collective action. So that's my way of saying it's complicated. It's messy. Like, right? That is what it is to human together. Yeah. And I think it is deeply both strategic and valuable to make sure that you are setting yourself up for decisions that feel empowering for you personally. And I also firmly believe that we should all have a level of financial agency and should be building that, even if you have a healthy, trusting relationship, right? We know that way too often, women of color may be in charge of household decisions like buying or, you know, just kind of childcare, everyday things, but we don't have kind of our own financial agency. Some people call it like an FU fund that is just there in backup. And so I think that always being able to have, whether it's in community with other women of color, kind of safe resources that we can rely on and pull from, like emergency funds, is really valuable and ties to this whole kind of conversation around collective protection. We often talk about like protecting community and have to remind ourselves that we are community, right? And we need to tend to ourselves in order to be able to participate and be sustained in the larger work of defending our more targeted and vulnerable brothers and sisters.
I love that. And I just wanted to say that, to add to that piece, is that this is the time for you to start understanding your own agency. We are in a position to take decisions and understand what we want with our money for ourselves, just like you did before you got married, just like you did when you had an awareness that you are a different individual than your parents, perhaps. Maybe this is the time that you don't take any action concrete, but you take accountability of what you're feeling and you start creating the action from that point. And I really wanted to touch on that because I know so many of you have sent that question over. And the answer is that it is a difficult answer. Nobody will have the final answer. Only you can start to find that solution. The good thing about this answer is that in your brain is already the option to live differently. So just start where you can and take that as a sign of starting your own agency and your financial kind of financial voice that you want to be having in maybe 6 months from now or a year from now, or if it is the conversation that you want to have with your partner as well.
That's right.
Jasmine, is there anything that we have not touched on that you think it is important for people to know right now?
Maybe I'll just kind of end with like a kind of summary of like how all of these things are connected, or at least attempt to weave it through. And that's that, you know, the systems that we operate under of extractive capitalism specifically monetizes and criminalizes human beings that they can treat as disposable labor and surveillance targets. Right now, that's migrants, right? Throughout history, we've seen it be different folks. And that's what fuels the aggressive enforcement of ICE raids and violence. Financial activism is about not just fighting against the immediate, you know, threats that there are. It's about how do we redirect capital away from the longstanding systems that profit from our exploitation and really think about moving towards community-rooted safety, support, dignity, collective action. And so like those are the kind of values that I know for me fuel my work, right? And my sustained kind of engagement in community. It's less about the kind of fight against protection. And that is deeply a privilege to not have to do that kind of immediate calculus of, you know, how do I protect myself and not be, you know, targeted by ICE in my current situation. But I think all of us can kind of gain, you know, some perspective when we think about not just what we're fighting against, but what we're fighting for. And what we're fighting for is beautiful and liberatory. And we are deeply deserving of that. And that is what is going to keep us going. So holding that collective vision in our minds as the fuel that pushes us forward.
Love it. Thank you so much, Jasmine. And I will link the book as well as all of the contacts down on the show notes. So just please do yourself a favor and check it out.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Did you hear something that you liked in today's episode? If so, don't keep it to yourself. Go ahead right now. Yes, right now, before this episode ends, and send this episode to those three friends, three girlfriends that you know you can go to talk about finance, independence, money, business, growth, entrepreneur life, and all of these juicy topics. Share this episode with them, because that is the only way we can grow together. I'm Alejandra Rojas, your host, and I will see you next week.